Live from the heart of the universe, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright
lights. With tonight's guest, systems theorist and founding chairman of Tunisian Millennium Project, Jalal Azim.
Look at the night sky.
And performance guest, Radhika Vakaria. I am Mark Lejeune, and now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
Our episode today, 869, is titled A Radical Hope-Based Blueprint for a New Humanity. Just the fact that we are talking about a hope-based blueprint in a radical way sounds radical. The concepts that are going to come up that Professor Jalal Azim will be sharing with us are at the same time very new and very old and very radical. And it's interesting, as I started to learn more about his work, there was a word that really caught my attention. And that word is Asabiya. Asabiya is an Arabic word. It sounded to me like Sicilian. Sicilian is a language. It's often referred to as a dialect of Italian, but it is actually a language and a written language and a cultural language. It is still used today. I grew up with that language, and Asabiya sounded so much like one of the words that we used in Sicilian. The interesting thing is, to those who don't know, that Sicily was an Arab country for over 200 years, and so a lot of the Sicilian words used still today are Arabic-based or actually Arabic words. I had to look up Asabiya to make sure that there wasn't potentially an Italian or Sicilian spelling of it, because it's definitely spelled in Arabic, and there wasn't, but there was a translation, and the translation was Gabasisi, and I thought, how interesting. And wait a minute, Gabasisi, I have heard used in kind of a derogatory way. So, Asabiya, the Arabic word, is a word that means social solidarity, and we'll get into that as we speak with our guests. It means group feeling or social cohesion, something that we can certainly use. And so, Gabasisi is meaning the same in Sicilian. Kabasisi, ironically, is also two Arabic words put together, and that is Hab al-Aziz, which is precious seed. And so if we look at precious seed, this word, I found it fascinating because the first place I went is something cherished, something valuable. It's used in the Bible, so it could have religious and spiritual connotations. But as I knew the word Gabasisi, it is used, if you all will excuse the expression, it's precious seed. You can imagine, as I'm going to say, they use it currently in the vernacular in Sicily as don't break my Gabasisi, or you're breaking my Gabasisi if you get my drift. And I thought, here's a word that has great history and great meaning and potentially something that we could use more of in this world, that has the meaning has been changed and the slang version, which is what's used most in the culture, in the language in Sicily now, is completely derogatory and used in that way. And I thought, how do we bring these concepts back And what a perfect time to do it. I can't wait to have this conversation with Jalal in just a moment.
I can't think of a more important conversation, especially this day and age when there's such a divisive nature amongst so many different aspects of humanity. Language being, the closest bridge, and yet being so misused or misunderstood, out of alignment. And the more we're learning, we talk about this, obviously, Filippo, a lot about words and frequency and things that we've learned in history, and maybe that it didn't support the intention. So really, really excited to explore.
And it feels like in the case of these words, and maybe even the concepts, and maybe even what the concepts, how they manifest, for example, family. The breaking up of family was more cool than coming together with family. Breaking up with our culture or our community even, and going outside the community, that was more cool.
Well, we've talked about this aspect also. I've been really considering lately the idea that humanity will look back and realize that separating education and entertainment and considering them separate will be one of our biggest mistakes. Mm. And so to what you're talking about, a lot of this gets normalized knowingly or unknowingly into, behavior sets or belief systems or, normal life.
Which ironically takes me back to precious seed, in the sense that the precious seed of who we are as humans and who the family nucleus is and who the community is, that's precious.
Speaking of precious seeds, thank you, Allison Goldwyn, for making the introduction to Jalal and doing everything that you do to bridge borders and connect worlds with synchronicity.
Indeed. And with that, once again, a radical hope-based blueprint for a new humanity. This is our episode 869. And our guest does so many things, but we're going to shorten the list just to get us started. And I hope all of this and more gets to come up during the interview. He is an academic researcher. He's a systems theorist, founding chairman of Tunisian Millennium Project Node. He is a WAAS fellow. I forgot what that stands for. He'll tell us in a moment. He's an author. He's a Neo-Caldunism, he's the author of an upcoming book, Neo-Caldunism, A Radical Hope-Based Blueprint for Post-Collapse Humanity. He's a professor. He's our guest today. Please welcome Professor Jalal Azeen. Welcome to the Life Changer Show.
Thank you very much, Filippo, for this introduction. And thank you very much also for the exchange you had right before you introduced me, because that sets the scene quite nicely to what we will be discussing. And I really enjoyed, making the link with some of the Sicilian terminology and how somehow these words, find their ways and change with time and, of course, and meanings.
Thank you for having inspired that research on my part. I was excited, and I'm excited to learn and have our audience be able to lean into some of what you're going to share. And speaking of the origin story, before we get into all the words, where did your love of or understanding of or study of Caldunism come?
Well, as you know, Ibn Khaldun is a Tunisian scholar, and he was born in Tunis about 7 centuries ago. So he's a Tunisian. He's very well known in the Arab Islamic world as well as internationally, and he wrote a lot of treaties, and one of the most known and best known of his books is the introduction. And in that introduction, he really, developed basically new sciences. And actually, he's the father of historiography, or history, scientific history, if you wish. So he's really a seminal thinker, and we learned about him in school, but I never really paid too much attention to his work early on. It's only when I started really getting to think about what humanity is going through these last few years, that somehow I went back to Ibn Khaldun to get inspirations and to try to see if his thinking, his philosophy, his science could somehow help us think our situation, and maybe help us conceive of a means to save humanity from itself. So it wasn't somehow, an automatic reaction somehow, or just using somebody I knew of. But I went back to him because I felt like he had something to offer. And of course, that was done after I've done some analysis and some understanding of our situation and why humanity finds itself in this very dire situation. So I went back to his Muqaddimah and whatever was written about him, and I found that he could be somehow a big help in conceiving of a way to save humanity from itself, but not just by taking his knowledge, his science, his philosophy as is, but after adapting it to our context and making it somehow useful for us to help us with our, undertaking.
Hence the Neo-Khaldunism that you share in your work.
Exactly. And that's how Neo-Khaldunism somehow sprang out of this dialectics, if I may say so, between my understanding of humanity's actual dire situation and my, how would I say it, my motivation to help one way or the other, even in an infinitesimal manner, and back to his writings, and especially his introduction, that somehow saw this Neo-Khaldunism spring out of these two components. And today I can say it is reasonably well structured, that it can be used as a platform to design and to come up with, as you earlier said, a blueprint, hopefully, to help us get out of our, situation.
So the Muqaddimah that you mentioned earlier, is that one of the first places he mentions the concept of Asabiya?
Indeed. It's called the introduction because it was the book that introduced a big, kind of many volumes document that he wrote about the history of humanity and specifically the Muslim world. And that first book that he called the introduction was basically the gem that everybody was able to read, analyze, and understand, and somehow learn about the great contribution of Ibn Khaldun to the science of history, of sociology, and many other fields of knowledge.
So in the research that I was doing, because your book isn't out yet, I haven't had the opportunity to read it and learn from you. I learned that Ibn Khaldun used that term asabiyya, and that asabiyya, the asab part, comes from bind, the word bind. So tell us more about the word and the philosophy behind asabiyya.
Yes, the Arabic etymology comes out from asab, which means the binding of parts. And in this case, Ibn Khaldun used it in the context of a group of people. He described with this word the cohesion and the solidarity of the group, okay? He used it also as being his main, parameter or state variable, you know, to understand the dynamics of a society or the behavior or the dynamical behavior of a group of people. He built a whole science around that, and he was able to explain how, for instance, a society or a tribe or even a civilization, you know, starts and builds itself to reach its zenith, its maximum, and then also tumbles down as somehow that asabiyya weakens and contributes to the decline of the group.
Interesting. I spoke of Sicily earlier, and if there's any country at the time that needed to stay united and binded because it was such a strategic place for war in the Mediterranean and for a lot of things, that they were conquered so many times that the Kasabia or Kabasisi would have been so important in order to be united. Then it obviously the word has taken on a different meaning. In the case of Asabiyya, you were telling me the same thing has happened or similar.
That's true. Word. Yeah, that's definitely true. Unfortunately, the word asabiyya somehow developed in the last maybe couple of centuries a negative connotation to it, which is really unfortunate because today that word is being used by top researchers to actually understand the dynamics of societies and even civilizations and find it of great use, to model the dynamics and the cyclicality, actually, of civilization. But unfortunately, in the Arab-Muslim world, the word somehow started getting some negative connotation to it and is much, much less used than it used before. And I believe that comes from the fact that this word was somehow related to religious, authorities, okay, or it was thought of being a religious binding, and not necessarily a social binding that helped, the development of a society or a group. So I believe that's really where this negative connotation somehow tinted this word, which is really unfortunate. And I hope with my work and the work of other scholars, the word will come back and will bring back its luster once people understand it's really a quite neutral And it's nothing but a descriptive word that tries to describe the cohesion and the solidarity of a group.
It's ironic that as the society has shifted away from this concept that the word, I don't know which came first actually, but the word actually has drifted away from potentially its original meaning and intent. And so why in your studies and in your findings and your work have you found that this is an important concept and a big part of the blueprint you envision, and for that matter, radical for Asabiya and the concepts behind it to be a big part of new humanity?
Wonderful question. Well, these are two actually questions and two very important ones. The first one is why Asabiya? Which I'll get back to it in a minute after I talk about the radical hope. Okay?
Okay. Yes.
Why it's radical hope and not hope? Because I believe if you would have asked me, or if you would have had this exchange a couple of years ago, I would have said or described our situation, I mean humanity's situation today, as being at a fork, or at a bifurcation point. And it's up to us to choose between either, going and saving humanity from itself, or continue on our actual path, business as usual, and, discover the demise that is awaiting us. But today, I can't say that, because I really believe that we have already chosen without choosing. In the sense that we are really now on a collapse path. And consequently, I do not know exactly what will happen, while we are kind of rushing on this path. There are different scenarios. We might be able to discuss these later on. But when you are on such a path, and it's an accelerating collapse, and you think that there is high probability that humanity might even disappear in a few decades, then hope won't help any longer. That's why one has to cling into what I call, or layers called, radical hope. Radical hope means acting, trying to find solutions, being, in a constructive mode, even if you ignore what will be the outcome of your action. So usually when we talk about hope, we kind of have a clear idea of the outcome of our action or whatever we are hoping for. Radical hope tells us you don't have to know what will happen. Okay, because it's beyond you. It's beyond even today's understanding and today's, meaning. But you have to act anyway. So that's really the motivation behind the radical hope, idea. Act even though you don't know what will be the outcome. Do the best you can do even though you don't know what will be the outcome. Okay, and
because our lives depend on it.
Exactly. So we cannot surrender. We cannot say, well, humanity is going to go extinct in a few decades, and consequently, let's just sit down and wait for the demise to happen. Absolutely no. We need to really, do the best we can do, and radical hope make us somehow proactive and hope for the best, between quotes, even though we don't know what is the outcome. So that's the radical hope part of the title of the book. Now comes the Asabiya, which is really central pillar of Neo-Khaldunism. And that pillar was also the central pillar of Khaldun's himself and his historiography 700 years ago. Because Ibn Khaldun 700 years ago was living in very similar circumstances, okay? You know, the world, especially in North Africa, was in havoc. He was somebody very close to politics. He was, you know, very close to the decision makers, and he had a keen understanding of the workings of politics, you know. So somehow Ibn Khaldun is a good reference, not because he was just a genius, but also he really experienced very, very similar dynamics. And he was involved within these dynamics. So the guy wasn't just, you know, theorizing, but he was living what he was writing about.
Mm.
So that's a very important, you know, component of my work.
Mm.
So why Asabiya? Because when I try to understand why we are today and the existential threats humanity is facing, it was very important to really identify the true underlying cause behind our existential threats. Of course, most of the people today think of economics as being, the economy as being really our biggest problem. They are to a high extent right, but not completely right. You know, of course, orthodox economics and especially neoliberalism somehow get us in big, big part into this situation. But to me, that's only a symptom. Economics and the way economics is working and how economics get us where we are is a symptom. So the question was, what is the underlying cause then? What really, why economics is what it is and why it got us where we are today? So when you look at that, you find out that economics was built on Cartesian epistemology. So it's a very clear mirror of Cartesian, you know, epistemology. And in Cartesianism, one of the important issue is dualism, okay? Mm-hmm. Where Descartes somehow make a split between the spirit and the body, between, you know, the observer and the observed.
Mm.
And these philosophical ideas are actually the foundation of our modernism, on which also orthodox economics was built on. And that's how we got to individualism. That's how we got into, you know, market dynamics as being an epistemic, you know, functioning system that works without the need of any intervention. That's why that these individuals were rational economic agents. All of these elements, when you put them together, they are really a perfect mirror of Cartesianism.
Does competition feed into that?
Yes, Cartesianism brings, you know, competition into the picture through this individualism.
Mm.
You see? Because somehow also it brings the separation between the observer and the observed, such as the humans and nature, you know, somehow makes of nature, you know, a source to be exploited and not to be cared for.
Mm.
All right. So all of these elements we can find them in Cartesianism. And to me, that is the actual cause of our problems. It's not directly economics, even though the economy and especially neoliberalism get us where we are. But that is nothing but, you know, Cartesianism. So to me, trying to change just the economy while leaving the epistemology untouched won't help us. So that's why we cannot stop just at the level of the economy, but we need to go one layer down and change our, you know, epistemology. So the dualism that Descartes brought out, as well as reductionism, also is another big ill of Cartesianism. So I'll stop here.
I'd love to say no, don't. It was such an important conversation, and so many different tie-ins to so much of what has been happening and what is happening and where it looks like we're going. And so to be radical now, it would be to have a turnaround back from us and them, me and you, me or us and the planet kind of thing to what?
Well, you know, this idea of trying to go from our deep individualism to a collective consciousness, that's really a tremendous challenge, because we have to really recognize that neoliberalism succeeded beautifully. I'm sorry to say beautifully, but, you know, in the sense that when success is there, we have to recognize it as such, even though its impact was and still extremely, extremely, how would I say it, nasty to humanity. The neoliberal system was able to condition basically all of us to these types of behaviors that made neoliberalism successful. But unfortunately, the success was positive only for a very, very small minority, to the detriment of the majority. And that's really one of the key conclusions that everybody today, you know, understand. And that's what is behind the tremendous inequality going on all over the world, all right? And inequalities themselves, you know, eat up somehow the social fabric and the asabiyah. When people feel like only a very small minority, and we usually call them the 1%, are extracting basically everything from the rest of us, the 99%, and leaving the rest of us with just crumbs to live on in a very, very precarious kind of lives, you can easily understand and conclude that our asabiyah somehow will decline and conflicts will emerge behind different groups of people. So you see, one of the big challenges of this problem is that it is really a hyper complex problem. And as you just said a few seconds ago, when you just touch one element, you find out that you are really also interconnected and connected to other very important issues as well.
Yes. So it's as if we want to, with this conversation in my mind, like want to completely stop and then start again. And just the inertia, like how does one completely stop? And then how does one build up the inertia to start again? And that I think is where the radical comes in, because maybe it's not that way. Do you have an idea of a way? Obviously, you have a blueprint.
Definitely, definitely. It's not, you see, in cybernetics, there is a very important principle. It's called the requisite variety principle. What that you know, that's a very simple principle, but an extremely powerful one, which says that to apprehend a complexity, you have to apprehend it with at least the same level of complexity. Okay? So, and we are facing a horrendous, you know, hyper-complexity. So no one in his mind would expect a simple solution. And that's part of the challenge as well. So as I said earlier, people are talking about, for instance, green growth, circular economy, donuts economy, degrowth, and what have you. That's not enough. Okay? Even if we really dive into degrowth or the donuts economy or what have you, we still have, you know, the same foundations. And that foundation will somehow break whatever new system we come up with, because the foundation is wrong. Okay? So we need to go back and really change the foundation. So the first thing to start with is that we need to really augment Cartesianism. I'm not calling, you know, to just demolish Cartesianism. No. Cartesianism gave us a lot of goodies. The advancement in science, all the technologies that we see today are the product of Cartesianism. So I'm not saying, you know, let's throw everything and repeat again. No. But my suggestion is to augment, you know, our epistemology with two more components so that it becomes a holistic kind of an epistemology. And that's the first step. And that's a big chapter by itself, which can get quite technical.
It sounds like it could at least be a book in its own.
Exactly. Exactly. And but it's a wonderful, you know, you see, when you get into these kind of, you know, research, somehow you discover things that you never, you know, expected, you know, and that's what keeps you going, because it's like a child who's discovering, let's say, a new toy or a new garden, you know, with all flowers that he never knew of and that he's discovering as he goes along with, you know, researching the issues he's interested in. So that's one big component, and that's a fundamental component. The other one is that, yes, we need to change the economy, but based on the new epistemology, of course. And that economy has to achieve two major goals. And that's where things got really also difficult. You see, one of our biggest problems today is that humanity is in a state of overshoot. You know, I'm sure, Filippo, that humanity today is using an average 1.75 planets to keep living the way we are living today. Have you ever seen another planet parked beside our planet? I don't think so. Okay? So we are using, you know, basically an extra planet to live the way we are living today. And that can't continue. That has to stop.
And we're still not happy.
Exactly. Exactly. We want more and more and more. Let me tell you this. If we, this is the average I told you, 1.75 is the average. But do you know, if humanity wanted to live like Americans, how many planets we would need? We would need five. You see? And when the politicians speak to us, they tell us, oh yeah, it's possible, we can all live, we can all have the American dream, irrespective of the fact if the American dream is achievable or not, all right? So we are in a state of overshoot since the early 70s, Filippo. It didn't start today, okay? So what we need to do is that those, the part of the world, which is usually the global north, which is living beyond its means, has somehow to, have a different way of living within the means of the planet. The same thing with the global south. But the problem with the global south is that most of the people are living below the necessary needs. And consequently, the global south has to kind of, develop so that it can respond to the minimal needs of its people. So you see, we need to really initiate two complementary dynamics so that the whole of humanity can live within the means of our mother planet. That is the challenge. And that cannot be achieved without asabiya.
Mm.
So you see how asabiya comes into the game?
I'm seeing it now.
Okay. So unless everybody understand that the cake is limited and we have to be just among each other and give each one of us the right amount he deserves, we cannot continue having one side devouring 99% of the cake, leaving the crumbs to the majority.
Mm, what an analogy.
And that's the big and the huge challenge, even after solving the epistemic problem.
So we know you're sharing this message with world leaders, and we know you're involved in a lot of different things. And there are people who are, I hope, addressing, I trust, I radically hope, are addressing these kinds of issues. And we each play a part in it. And as we bring this conversation too quickly to a close, unfortunately, it seems like it is a conversation that we need to be having at length, all of us. In the meantime, what can we do? And that might be part of it, is that we can have these conversations in our heads and with our neighbors, with our friends, in our families, in our communities. What are, because you said how Ibn Khaldun lived his philosophy, how is potentially living each of us individually at the moment, or not individually, maybe that's the problem, how do we live some of that in support of what you're envisioning?
Filippo, we can't do this individually, even though each one of us can contribute to some extent. But to actually engage and initiate these dynamics I was describing, it has to be done collectively. And the only way to do it is for humanity somehow to develop this collective consciousness and consequently asabiya and the right, blueprint to actually soften the blow that is coming and save as much as we can of this humanity so that a new departure can be initiated. So we need to collaborate. We need to put our hands together and do what we must do to actually save humanity from itself. Mm. Otherwise, you know, humanity won't exist by the end of the century. As simple as that. And that's why radical hope is a must, not a choice.
So looking to collaborate, because I believe in a microcosm, we can affect the macrocosm to collaborate more, to be in peace with each other more in our life today and going forward. And obviously with the concept of doing bigger and better. Yes?
Definitely, the microcosms will play an important role, you know, in these dynamics. But the challenge also, Filippo, is that, you know, the window of opportunity is closing very, very fast. You see, I don't know if you have noticed, like the last couple of years, things have been changing so quickly and so drastically that we can't even keep up with what's going on. So time is running very, very fast, and we cannot just wait and see. We have to act. And when I say cooperation, collaboration, that is very, very much needed for us to pull our resources, you know, together to actually face this challenge and, as I said, soften the blow and reignite a new civilization.
Well, I am glad we've collaborated our resources here, all of us together, time and energy and effort to come together to have this conversation. Thank you for sharing as you have, for taking the time to share with us from Tunisia here on the Life Changes Show. I want to let everybody know that Professor Jalel is J-E-L-E-L, and Ezine, E-Z-Z-I-N-E. We have several links for him, including a short video and a couple profiles there at the Life Changes Show page for him. But of course, you could find him directly on LinkedIn at Jalel Ezine, as I spelled it. Anywhere else we should send people?
Well, that's good enough. There is also my Twitter account or X account. And Facebook with the same name.
Same name? Okay, very good. And I trust if people follow you there, when the book comes out, for them to learn more, that we will get to learn about it then, right?
Sure.
Okay, well, if you share with us, we will share with our audience as well. In the meantime, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for this conversation and for what you're bringing.
Thank you very much, Filippo, and your team for having me.
Our pleasure. And a big thank you to Professor Jalel Ezine. Mark, you know, this word hope has been used so much, and it sometimes can feel stagnant. Interesting, this radical hope that Professor Jalel brings, it almost feels more like a verb, like there's an action. Let's get radically hopeful, or let's get...
Yeah, he really does inspire action. And I think that's a good point, because a lot of people kind of fall into hope passively, you know, like, okay, I'm gonna be over here hoping. Whereas putting it into a proactive state of energy is, I think, a great start.
Yeah, as opposed to like, oh, I hope so, but I radically hope. Yeah,
almost willing it to happen, or intending, different than holding hope but doubting at the same time.
And all these words that were brought into this conversation from the monologue throughout the until now, that words are not just words as we know from music and frequency and sounds, and so the words are important. And if we need new words, we need new words, but Definitely the energy behind them.
There's a new meme for you. Words are not just words. Filippo Voltager.
What was it that your son said actually on the show?
When you think that one thing is one thing, but it's not.
It's not. Well, brilliant. Jet Paul, we love you. And loved this conversation. Look forward to more. And with that, we have our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Richard, and I want to know how to release this burden of anger and resentment that I have with my father's present wife. Thanksgiving is coming, and I am invited to the family celebration, but it is not fun at all, and I walk away sadder and angrier and more resentful than I was before. What can I do to stop this nonsense?
Dear Richard, I feel the pain in what you're describing. When family gatherings stir up anger, resentment, or old wounds, it can feel like you're trapped in a cycle you know is toxic but can't seem to break. However, you're already ahead of the curve by wanting to end the nonsense rather than keep replaying it. The first step you can take to change this is for you to recognize that her behavior, energy, and choices are hers, not yours. Let's change your reaction, that anger and sadness, and take control of your thoughts and your feelings. Please take a moment to remember that her actions are not your responsibility. You can choose peace, even if she doesn't. You can shift from reaction to observation. And a very helpful thing you can do when you're around her is to become the observer, as if you are watching a play. You're not in the drama. You're watching it unfold. If she says something that pushes your buttons, take a slow breath and observe and realize that this is just who she is. This creates just enough space between stimulus and response, and that space is your freedom. And please remember that you don't have to stay the whole evening. You are the power in your world, and you have many choices in this situation. You can choose to arrive later or leave earlier. And if you want to stay when things get unpleasant, you can take a moment to step outside when emotions rise and take a short walk. This can reset your nervous system. And most importantly, you can even decide not to go this year if you dislike it so much. Setting boundaries in situations such as this are protection for your well-being. And let's not forget that Thanksgiving doesn't have to be defined by family tension. You could choose to make a plan that feeds your spirit. You could invite a friend over for your own Thanksgiving celebration and celebrate this special day on your own terms. Thanksgiving is truly a day on which we can express our gratitude for the good in our lives if we choose to make the best choices possible for ourselves and the ones we love.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you have a question for Dorothy, please write her, thankfully, at askdorothy@lifechangesshow.com.
And for our performance segment, we have a very special performance guest. She is a Grammy-nominated and award-winning multi-instrumentalist. She's a sensory artist. She's a composer. We welcome Radhika Vakharia to the Life Changes Show. Welcome, Radhika.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. And I didn't say in the introduction, but cartographer of the soul is something that people say you are. What is that part?
Well, I like maps, and apparently I help people map back to themselves.
Do you really like maps?
I do.
Oh, wow.
I do.
You are fascinating, actually, because I'm going to share another thing. Besides your music, like all these other things, do you mind telling us about the map story?
Well, I happen to love maps as a kid. Even now, if I see a map, I will dive in. But it has been said that when people experience the music, or we have been, in union and in experience, people tend to find themselves. They find a way back to themselves.
How beautiful!
Mm-hmm.
And actually, so now as a child, you were also interested in something else which relates. And what is that?
Surgery, actually.
Yes.
When I was younger, I wanted to be a surgeon. I wanted to remove tumors for people, actually.
Remove tumors for people. Wow. Mm-hmm. What did the transition to music do for that dream?
My goodness, how long is this show?
For you?
Well, I think that, as a child, I wanted to be a surgeon. And my father did the most un-Indian thing a father can do, was to discourage me from being a surgeon.
Wow.
yes. It was the most uncultural, it was the most unsteady cultural thing to do. But, you know, my father obviously knew me very well. We were very close. And he said, you love music and you love the world and you love being with people. If you go for this path, you won't get to do any of these other things. I don't think he fathomed me being a singer full time, because, you know, that wasn't going to necessarily lead to being a steady career, or in the eyes of your parents, you know, they worry. But I'm somewhat of a rebel, and I have a rebellious spirit. And I said, well, if I'm not going to be a surgeon, I don't want to have anything to do with medicine. So I took a big detour in my life and went to mathematics and economics, and because I was very good at mathematics. And but I took a long detour. But music was always, you know, it's music is in my pulse. So I was always singing, always activating that part of myself.
When did you start singing?
Before I could speak, actually. I couldn't, I was singing melodies pretty much as soon as I could make a sound. My parents loved music. There was always music in the home. My dad was an amateur singer. Well, not amateur, actually got invited to be a professional in India, but he loved his family so much he didn't want to be away from them. So, but music is, you know, music is as old as oxygen to me. I was listening in the womb. So I was singing perfect melodies before I could string a sentence together.
So you were born in England, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so how would you describe the music scene around you outside the home?
Very eclectic. Yes. I mean, my father brought me up on Indian music as well as jazz. He was a huge Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra fan. So I grew up with a lot of old American jazz. I grew up listening to Ella Fitzgerald, Nancy Wilson, Nina Simone, a lot of R&B, a lot of soul music. I grew up with a lot of music. My brother would import vinyls from America. So my taste in music was very vast, but I also had a very deep love for classical music. Huge love for classical music. I played piano since I was 6 years old, classically trained. So I just, you know, it's music is everything to me. It's my life.
Well, we're going to get to experience a couple of your pieces. And before we do, when you're creating music, where does that come from for you? Is it for you? Is it something that you're doing for others? Is it something that the world, energies, God is asking for? What is it for you?
It could be any one of those things separately or at the same time, to be honest. That's a very interesting question. I mean, I think that anytime I sit and create, it's because there's something inside that wants to be expressed. And if I am in tune, then I guess that's going to serve other people, because we're all so connected, right? So what one human being has a desire to express is probably intrinsically answering what another human being needs to hear. Mm. And on the other side, or I guess wrapped into that, most of the time, when I listen back to anything that I have, I guess, played a part in creating, I would say it's a part in creating it. It's kind of unfathomable to me what is coming out. And I do believe that it is past lives that are coming through. I believe it's something else that is working through, because it's quite astounding, actually. And I sometimes walk into the room if someone's playing my music, and I find myself saying, "Who is that?"
Wow.
It's very interesting. When I started to create music that is birthed from Sanskrit and Vedic philosophy and these meanings, more often than not, I would listen back saying, "Who is she?" Still now, I will listen to it and say, "Who is that?" And that's a beautiful place to be, actually, that the kind of separateness and that observer stance, because it makes you less attached to what you have created, and you can enjoy and be in the wonder of it. And actually it reinforces this idea that it didn't actually come from me. It probably came through me. And that's a beautiful space to be in, because if I was so attached to my music and thought that all of it was me, I'd probably be a lot more critical about it and not be able to step back in the wonder of it. But I don't believe that the more I do this, I don't believe we make music. I think music makes us.
Wow. Does that relate to the surgery in the sense of the healing is happening because the music is making us?
I believe that sound has a divine intelligence when we allow it to be expressed in its pure form. Everything, you know, the sound is pure. The sound is already there. All of the sounds that we hear in the world were waiting to be expressed. It has an intelligence of its own. It wants to reach you on a cellular level. And so the surgeon wields their hand. There's a divine intelligence of healing that happens. And the surgeon plays a role in just bringing that from the immaterial to the material. And I do believe that sound is the same way. And when you fall in humility to a purpose, or life hits you hard enough to make you realize, hey, that's not your path, this is your path, and you surrender to it, you do become an instrument. I believe every human being is an instrument waiting to be used for a purpose. And we kind of need to just step out of the way of our minds oftentimes and just bow our heads. And it's in that place that you can receive this intelligence. There's something so high that we probably will never quite understand, but to be part of it and to be useful for it to play and serve the way that it needs to and reach people in the way that they need is, you know, that to me is a life worth living. My life has much more fulfillment and ease the moment I started to do that.
An answer you just gave earlier reminds me of something I said to you when we first connected on the phone after hearing your music and lots of it and enjoying it. But beyond enjoying it, I said to you that it feels like, well, I said you're putting in your music, but maybe is coming out through your music something that wants to be felt, and that you are aware of this. And so what you said earlier brought these thoughts together, that sometimes something inside you wants to be expressed, and we usually interpret that as something that you want and you are going through. But if you are connected, as I'm hearing and feeling, to all that is, or as much of humanity as possible, that potentially that you is us.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the concept, you know, when that concept of I am eventually as a collective leads to we are. So, yes, it is something, I think all human beings have a connection of experience and desire to feel. And, you know, just this human experience is not really unique to any of us. You know, we are unique individuals in this material form. But a spirit of our human consciousness is connected. We are connected. There is absolutely no denying that. And that's why music is such a powerful form, because a song made by one person can resonate with millions of people. How is that possible? I've written or co-created pieces where people have said, how did you know I needed to hear that? I'm like, well, because I am you and you are me and we are. So there's a higher probability of that happening, right? It's such a beautiful reminder of our connection.
Well, thank you for that beautiful reminder of our connection. And where do you know where Liberate came from, the song that we're going to hear now?
Oh my goodness. Liberate, if I'm very honest, it came out of a lot of pain. A lot of pain. You know, the world was shut down at that time. Everyone was isolated in their own way, whether it was their individualized experience, their circumstances of their own lives, regardless of what was going on in the world. And then, you know, layered on top of that, we were all very isolated. And I think many of us, when we're isolated or the patterns of our lives are, you know, jolted, we tend to question everything. And I think at that time, many of us were questioning what we believed to be true, what we had been told, what we had believed all of our lives, what we thought that life was going to be, what the world was spinning at. And many of us, even us on some kind of conscious spiritual path, I will say conscious because I believe everybody is on a path, whether they realize it or not. Many of us even questioned our faith. We question, you know, this idea of the divine when things are falling around us. And I think it's important to be honest. So the first line of that song says, are you there in the corners of the darkness? It was a very innocent moment of sitting in silence and solitude and asking the divine, where are you? Where are you? And the mantra in this song is the Mahamrityunjaya mantra. And it's actually called the death conquering mantra. Wow. It's called the death conquering mantra, and it's extremely powerful. It's from the Rig Veda. It's very, very old. It's very powerful, and it helps us face our fears. And any fears that we have is born out of facing the end of something, whether it's a relationship, whether it's our life, whether it's circumstance. It's the death of that something that scares us so. And this mantra held me. I'll be honest, even on a spiritual path, it's not going to make you fully impervious to physical reactions and experiences that we have. I'm never going to lie and present as someone on a lotus cloud that nothing has affected them. I think it's important to be spiritually real. It is very, very important. And these mantras and these sounds and these practices help activate a little more grace so that we can pass through these experiences. And this particular mantra helped me so much in a time where I thought the cord was being cut. I thought my lifeline was being cut. And so this song very naturally came about. You know, the mantra is always the core of the sound. And the lyric in English was almost the question, and the mantra is the answer.
Well, here it is on the Life Changer Show. It's pre-recorded. This is Radhika Vakaria's piece, Liberate.
Because
Cause I feel you hear me calling. Let me fall, fall away from underneath my feelings. Let me go to the unknown where we're found. Om Trayambakam Yajamahi Sugandhim Pushti Vardhana Urvairakamiva Bandhanan Mrityur Mukshiya Mamrita. Om Trayambakam Yajamahi Sugandhim Pushti Vardhana Urvairakamiva Bandhanan Mrityur Mukshiya Mamrita.
Thank you. I'm feeling that. I think we're all feeling that. And what a perfect song for the conversation that we've been having since the beginning of the show and moving into this new humanity. May we all feel a liberation from the way things have been. And I want to share first off with the audience how people can find you, Radhika. Of course, we have links for her at the Life Changes Show. And you could go there, and I'll spell her name because this is her website and her Instagram and also on YouTube, etc. You'll find her at Radhika, R-A-D-I-H-K-A. And Vekaria, V-E-K-A-R-I-A. IA.
And Radhika, I wanted to jump in and also acknowledge beyond all the magic that we're learning, that is you. You are involved in a very special collaboration. And thanks to Natalie Bonan for the introduction here and all the great work you are both doing around the biometric feedback and sound and breathwork healing, and really starting to take this wisdom and music and frequency to a whole new level.
Yeah, it's been a great collaboration. We got to record an album called Sacred Echoes with the Vienna Synchron Orchestra and at School Farm Studios, and it was a coming together of devotional Sanskrit and orchestral music, which has always been a dream of mine to do because I've loved classical music growing up. So the convergence of those worlds has been really meaningful.
Is that from the album of the second piece we're going to hear?
No, the two pieces are from my album called Warriors of Light, which was thematically all about resilience and transformation.
Very nice. Is that mm-hmm. the one also that you received the Grammy nomination for?
Yes, Warriors of Light did, yes.
Very nice, very nice. Well, we'll get to the second piece in just a moment. I was asking you if you spoke other languages. You don't speak Sanskrit, but you sing in it, right?
I sing in it, yeah. I mean, you can speak in it, but it's not really a commonly spoken language. So
I would gather.
But it's a very sacred language, so you sing in it, yes.
Mm-hmm. And the other languages, I loved the story because I asked you if you would speak in one of them for me. Tell us about where your family comes from.
Well, it is the Gujarati language, Gujarati, from Gujarat. That's where my grandparents actually come from. My parents were born in Africa, actually. They were born in East Africa, and my grandparents are from India. And the Gujarati language is what I heard growing up as a child, and I speak a little bit of that.
What can you say for us in the Gujarati language?
Man bolga meche aasho upar hubuluchu manu music mo kushave. Which means I'm very much enjoying being on this show and talking about my music brings me peace and joy.
Well, I was going to say it sounds beautiful, so I must have picked up on the vibe.
Well, there's a vibration to these languages, right? So Gujarati, all of these languages and a lot of European languages are birthed from Sanskrit. And Sanskrit has a strong vibration that we can, it's a natural vibration. It's a language that really is a becoming language. It was derived and experienced from nature itself. So it makes sense that you would get a sense of what I'm saying because you are nature.
Thank you. Well, you as an artist today, and today especially since I believe, and I know you do too, the role of the artist is more important today than ever and going forward. What is that about for you?
Well, the artist is there to not only express what they are here to express, but to remind everybody that they have an artist within them. We are walking pieces of art. Nature made us. And yet we have been living for a long time, shutting that part of ourselves down. And as the world becomes more digitized, which I don't have an issue with, I think there is such a thing as positive technology, but we cannot negate and forget our intrinsic value as creative beings. And so I do believe that there is going to be a creative revolution. And I don't think it's something that we have to force. I think it's something that's organically going to happen because it is natural to us to express that. You even see it now. You see that in a world that has become more 2D, very screen oriented, people are finding, you know, they're discovering watercolors and they're finding all these ways to be more dexterous and live a more textural life, you know, to paint and dance and move. So as things become more extreme in one direction, you are going to, people naturally want to experience what is organic. And what is organic is going to be healthy for us. We do have a natural tendency to do that, no matter how long it takes us to get there. There is something that shifts in the human being. It says, I want to experience something real and tangible and visceral. So I think that there is already emerging a creative revolution. I think that human beings are always going to have this innate need to express themselves. And artists, you know, artists on one hand are brave, but also they are also doing what is natural to them. You know, it's hard for an artist not to live like that. And I think that alone teaches the rest of us how we can be. You know, for me, anytime I attempted to leave music, it sounds so dramatic, right? It's very, very dramatic. You know, I've had many Gone with the Wind moments. This is where I'm going to show that I grew up on old American movies. You know, that scene where Viv Scarlett O'Hara is standing on that, you know, hill and saying, "As God is my witness, I shall never go hungry again." I've had many moments like that. It was very dramatic. I've had very many moments. If there was any character I wanted to play in a movie, it would be Scarlett O'Hara.
I'm not ruling it out. I mean, it's going to show up somewhere. I just know.
I'm telling you, I'm going to be, you know. But that line, "As God is my witness," is not foreign to me, right? It was very dramatic. And I've had many of those moments. And I think that many of us make these vows. I'll be honest with you, you know, many years ago, I had that moment in Germany. I was in a show that, you know, I was singing 8 to 10 shows a week, and I was singing songs in Indian languages and Western languages. It was, you know, one of the highest highs of my life. And the show shut down suddenly, and it crushed me. It absolutely crushed me, because I was on this creative just juggernaut. I was just expressing all these aspects of myself, and the show got shut down. And I made a vow, actually, I made a vow in 2010 to never actually sing again.
Wow.
In 2010, I said, "As I will never sing again," because I was so heartbroken. And I thought, you know, where else is there left to go? Can you believe that? Where else is there left to go? And I had that moment. I've had many of those moments. And let's just say, you know, I'm really glad that that vow got broken. I've had other people say, "I'm really glad that vow got broken." You can make all the promises in the world and have all the reactions in the world. And God has different plans for you.
Did you literally say, "As God is my witness"?
Yes, I did. I actually did.
And did you listen to hear God laugh or what?
I think God has laughed at me, chuckled at me, found us amusing.
Lovingly, I'm sure.
Spanked me. I have been spanked by the universe lovingly and hard very many times, because we don't know all the possibilities of what life has in store for us. We know a fraction of what is possible. If you had told me even just a handful of years ago that I would be making music, traveling the world, sharing Vedic philosophy, singing in Sanskrit, Tamil, and Avadi, in these different languages in English, and be nominated for an album that was all about resilience, and I would have laughed at you. Because that is a path that hasn't been... My path is nobody else's path. Your path is nobody else's path. Nobody has the same path. And most of us are making choices based on what we've already seen transpire in the world. That is so small. That is a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what is possible. We just don't know what is going to unfold.
One thing we did know when we first connected, we thought, "Oh, wow, we're going to go on, and it's still not going to be enough." And here we are. And I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I have to say that I think you're the person to ask this question. I haven't thought about it in a long time. And when I sang more to audiences, and I would tell stories, and though I sang other people's songs, I would tell a story beforehand or sing the song in a way that people would cry or hold the person's hand next to them, their loved one or whomever. And then afterwards, there'd be people crying or wanting a hug and I didn't know what that was about. And there's a whole other story there that we won't get into. But a friend of mine would say to me, Well, you're just an entertainer. You're just entertaining. So, and I'd say it's not just entertaining. I'm not just performing. Something else is happening. And I have a feeling you have, like, what's this happening? Like healing versus performing, which is something I know you talk about. So let's.
Well, there's entertainment and then there's transformation.
Ah.
I'm disinterested in entertaining people. There's enough of that in the world. I have no interest in that. And I really, like, you know, one of my taglines is, I don't make music for you to see me, I make it for you to see yourself.
Wow. Drop mic.
So when that happens in, I'm not going to say audience, I'm going to say the co-creators. Right, that are bearing witness not only to the sound, but bearing witness to what is occurring in themselves. And when people cry, God, how lucky are we that we've experienced that? Can we just take a moment? That just makes me very emotional to have experienced conveying music that moves people to the point that they cry. Whew, that just really hit me. You know, and I think what happens for people is there is this peace that it's almost overwhelming, because the sound, your heart is reaching out to people as you're singing. If you're reaching out to God, you're reaching out to people. Mm. It's the same thing, because God is in everyone, right? So if you're singing to the divine, you're singing to something higher in yourself, you're singing to something higher in other people. And they get a glimpse of that, and they get to see themselves for the first time, or the first time in a long time. I cannot tell you the amount of people that have said, I was able to speak certain things for the first time in my life after hearing you. I left my abusive husband of 20 years after hearing this once. I have, you know, I feel I'm having chemotherapy, and nothing brings me a painless experience like this. Because I do believe that when you, the music helps you see yourself actually as you are, actually as you are. Most of us are walking around not presenting ourselves or showing ourselves as we actually are. We are bombarded with impressions in this world. This whole world is just this maze of illusion. It's a beautiful illusion. It's beautiful. And there's so much to realize. But we are distracted. We are exiled from our own kingdom. We don't walk sovereign in ourselves. And so when you create a sound or an experience that somebody can take that seat on their throne again and be who they are, transformation is simply becoming who you always were. You are not becoming anything new. Everyone thinks transformation is becoming something else. I have no interest in turning you into something else. Transformation is simply the realization of what you are, who you are, all along, from the moment you were born, the moment you came as a soul into being. You're already full and whole. You're already full and whole. And the sound serves you vibrationally to shake off everything that has made you believe that you are something else. So when people cry, it's like wiping that mirror and seeing yourself for the first time and realizing, my God, I am.
Beautifully expressed. And with such a beautiful voice, I you're singing and you're speaking. I could listen to you speak. You could speak the Sanskrit prayers, actually. Have you thought of that?
Yes, I actually do. And okay. Actually do that too, yes.
Well, especially since our next piece that we're going to play, your next piece, is tied into everything we've been talking about. But why Warriors of Light, like, what does that mean? And that, of course, is the title of the album. And I think the tagline is Music as Medicine for Modern Times. Tell us about that.
Well, we live in a very different world to when the sages and seers in India were around. You know, you're talking 5-10,000 years ago. The world is very different. So we have to serve what is needed now in the way that can be received. And this music, I think it was conscious and unconscious, you know, the way that this album came about. My mentor, was, you know, I was talking with her one day. She passed away actually 5 days after the nomination. Like, and Divya Prabha, Divya said to me, she goes, this album's going to be really powerful. And I said, yeah, there's a warrior theme that's emerging in this album. I didn't plan for it, but there is this theme of resilience and strength and transformation. And I said, I don't know what to name it. And Divya said, how about Warrior of Light? And I went, well, how about Warriors of Light? Because every song on the album, pretty much every song on the album, expresses a form of the divine that has this warrior spirit, right? You've got Durga, you've got Rudra, you've got Ram, you've got all of these expressions of the divine that are really warrior figures that are here to protect and serve your transformation and your realization. And so that's how the album came about. And the next song, Haganita Tara, it means the dance of countless stars. And this song, the lyrics, Sage Hagastya wrote these lyrics 4,500 years ago.
Wow.
And when I heard these lyrics, I heard one of the forms of compositions of this, my whole being changed. I swear that from that moment on, my life has just, it's shifted. These words, and it's such an honor to have learned the Tamil. It's in Tamil, it's not in Sanskrit. Tamil, some people say, is older. And I had to learn phonetically. I had to learn how to pronounce this because it's not a native language, at least to my lineage. But I had to sing this song. I had to. And so it's called The Dance of Countless Stars, Aganita Tara.
Wow. And we're going to get to hear it now here on the Life Changes Show. It's pre-recorded, of course, from the album Warriors of Light. Here is Radhika Vakaria's Aganita Tara.
Tara ganangalin naduvi aganita tara ganangalin naduvi adhi parashakti adgindrai adhi parashakti adgindrai sakala characharatum thanga chillambulike sakala characharatum தங்க சிலம்புலிக்கே ஜகதீஸ்வரியவள் ஆடுகின்றாள் ஜகதீஸ்வரியவள் ஆடுகின்றாள் அகணித தாரா கணங்களின் நடுவி ஆதி பராசக்தி ஆடுகின்றாள் அரியன அழிப்பால் அயன் என்ன வருவா har Akhilandeshwari Arghindra Aganit Tara Ganangale Nadubi Adhipara Shakti Arghindra
And there we have it. Wow, so powerful. Radhika Vakharia. Again, I'm going to spell that for everybody because you'll find her on Instagram and all over with the name Radhika and Vekaria. Again, you can find her on the Life Changes show page or web, on her own website, which is thename.com, and then on Instagram, YouTube, etc., etc. And your music is available where music is available.
Everywhere and in your mind and heart too.
Thank you for coming into our mind and hearts by way of this show and our awareness for those who were not aware of you, your music, and your consciousness. And thank you for sharing as deeply as you have. Have you always been this deep?
Unfortunately, yes. I like the ocean. Why not?
You like the ocean. Let me guess, you wanted to be an oceanographer too.
I, you know, going back to the whole maps thing, whenever I would look at an atlas, my parents had the old Britannica atlas, and I would flip to the pages that had mostly ocean and just sit there mesmerized for hours. So.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. What does your name Radhika mean? And I ask you for because I want to know, and then also because it's interesting how the title of this episode is a radical hope-based blueprint for a new humanity. And as I was about to say your name, I was thinking radical, a Radhika hope. So tell us, tell us what it means.
That should be the name of my next album, A Radical Hope.
Nice.
So Radhika comes from, there's a few different names, meaning. So it comes from Radha, who is the kind of partner or consort of Krishna. And really, Krishna represents the highest consciousness, universal consciousness, and Radha really depicts that which inspires the highest consciousness. But Radhika also comes from, you know, if you break it down, Ra from Sanskrit is love, light, and radiance. And then Radhika is like never ending or the embodiment of. So it's really she's the embodiment of love.
What more can one ask for in a name for you and your music?
No pressure at all. My father knew he wanted to name me that even before he knew he was going to have kids. He already had his kids' names picked out. So I'm very grateful when people say my name and when people who are not from the culture make an attempt to say my name because it keeps his memory alive for me.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So thank you
for sharing. Thank you. And looking forward to so much more and to your music, of course, and to more of your stories and insights. What a pleasure this has been.
For me too. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. With a big thank you to Radhika Vakharia, our performance guest, and another big thank you to Professor Jalal Azeen, our interview guest. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark Lejeune, and our whole family here at the Life Changes Show, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, as ours surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at the Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.